Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. If you've been listening to my show for several years, you know that I am quite concerned and have been concerned since at least 2011, which, wow, 4 years, more than 4 years ago, about what was going on in Syria. Long before any of us had ever heard of ISIS, long before President Obama started talking about Assad, I was talking about the Arab Spring and Syria, and the fact that ordinary people, students and shopkeepers and truck drivers and electricians and basically ordinary Syrian people wanted to live free. They wanted to live without their totalitarian government, the dictator Bashar al-Assad. They wanted to basically live in a democracy, and they, like people throughout the Middle East, were rising up. They rose up in Iran, they rose up in Libya, they rose up in virtually every country, we all know about Egypt, to try to live a better life. Unlike some countries that allowed, in Tunisia, for example, allowed the people to have a democracy, and in other countries where there were demonstrations in the streets, the dictator Bashar al-Assad, much like his father, decided simply to massacre them all. To kill as many Syrian civilians as possible. First he killed 1,000, then 10,000. Around that time I started complaining right here, right on this station, right on all these stations that I'm on, that we needed to have a no-fly zone to prevent these people from being massacred. Then Assad started dropping barrel bombs. These are bombs, they're actually much larger than barrels, they're about the size of Dimsty dumpsters. Bombs flattening suburban neighborhoods. These weren't used in a war zone. They were designed to kill as many civilians as possible. Again, we did nothing. Then they started using poison gas. Barack Obama said, no, you can't do that. You can't use poison gas. So he demanded that Syria get rid of the poison gas. They did for a time while still dropping these barrel bombs. Now they're back to using gas. And now the Russians are involved, helping Assad massacre as many Syrians as possible. The number is more than 200,000. It's approaching 300,000. And there are millions of Syrian refugees all over the globe. I mention this because, well, it predates ISIS. Most Americans, I think, are not even aware of this. They know there's trouble in Syria. They mostly know about ISIS. ISIS is a terrorist organization that is really good at flair, at getting attention. They behead one or two or five or 10 foreign journalists. And because I guess the journalists are Americans, we are outraged. We are determined to stop ISIS because of 5 or 10 or 20 Americans murdered instead of noticing the hundreds of thousands of Syrian civilians that Assad is killing with the help of Iran and the help of Russia. I think it's fair to say that ISIS is not the cause of any of the problems in the Middle East so much as the result. In other words, with enough people get massacred, people turn to horrific terrorist organizations like ISIS. Now, this is certainly not a defense of ISIS. But in our battle against ISIS, we need to recognize what it's all about. ISIS is a result of the massacre of the Syrian government with the help of Iran and Russia of its own people, not the cause. So when Hillary Clinton talks about this situation, unlike when President Obama does, I think she has a much clearer understanding of the complexities of the situation. At a time when the Washington Post has a front page article talking about the Russians going after the one group in Syria that's decent human beings, the Free Syrian Army, some of whom have been on this show, ordinary people forced to fight. There's so many different terrorist groups in Syria. The biggest and largest and most powerful terrorist group is Russia. and Iran and the Syrian government, backed by the Iranian terrorist group Hezbollah, that's going around massacring as many Syrians as possible. They're the largest and most dangerous terrorist group. The second largest and most dangerous terrorist group, of course, is ISIS. And then there's others. There's al-Nusra, which is an affiliate of al-Qaeda. How ironic that al-Qaeda is the third most dangerous group in Syria. But Moscow and Iran, they're not focused on ISIS. They say they are. No, they're focused on killing every last innocent person in Syria. And we're doing nothing. Nothing about it. Hillary Clinton was asked these very difficult questions on Meet the Press recently. Actually, it was on the Monday program following Meet the Press. Unfortunately, the real Meet the Press, the one on Sunday, Chuck Todd asked Hillary all these questions about her email accounts, which I think are tiny and irrelevant and a waste of time. I think she handled these questions very well, frankly, but I do think it's mostly a waste of time. What I found most interesting was the follow-up interview, the one that occurred on Monday, the one that virtually no one watched, the one where Hillary Clinton was asked very tough policy questions on foreign policy. I think she acquitted herself very well. Let's play some of that interview.
Here in Syria, and obviously there's a lot going on, including this week at the United Nations, about what to do with Syria. Can you defeat ISIS if Assad is still running Syria?
I think it's very difficult. I think that we're going to have to, as they say, walk and chew gum at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that will be to, you know, do the best we can with our friends in the region to go after ISIS and try to, you know, push them out of Iraq and then try to, you know, deal with them and the territory they control in Syria. But one of the challenges is that a lot of the groups that are fighting on the ground, their primary focus is still Assad. We have now the added complexity of Russia with military troops and equipment on the ground in Syria. They are there primarily to defend Assad, secondarily to, as they say, fight terrorists. We've always had Iran in there. Hezbollah is one of the mainstays of the Assad regime. So it is a very complicated political situation and battlefield to go after ISIS.
What does a President Clinton prioritize? Do you prioritize ousting Assad?
I would prioritize both. You can't really do one without the other, but ousting Assad has to be a political process.
I was just going to say, yeah, is it only a political process? You can't make it a military process?
You can't. And I think we have our hands full with ISIS. And I think part of the challenge that President Obama has been facing is to build up the Iraqi forces again after Maliki decimated them, and to get them in a fighting position, and to get the Kurds, particularly the Peshmerga, able to be fully equipped, then to try to go after ISIS in Iraq, in Ramadi, in Mosul, pushing them out if possible.
You said in an interview about a year ago, don't do stupid stuff is not an organizing principle for foreign policy. And I know that it became a little bit of a tiff between the administration and you, and you claimed it wasn't about that. But so let me ask this, what is your organizing principle when it comes to American foreign policy?
Well, my organizing principle is that we defend our security, our interests, and our values, and we do so in concert with partners, friends, and allies around the world. And we do it the way that I did the coalition to put together the sanctions, the unprecedented sanctions against Iran. You have to bring people together. You have to find common ground. The United States had a very clear interest in getting Iran to the negotiating table to deal with their nuclear weapons program. Other countries were not as intensely focused on that. I had to work to get them so. And that's the kind of slow, steady, persistent diplomacy that will further our values, our interests, and our security.
Let me go back to Syria. You were an advocate, a stronger advocate than others in the administration, of training some rebels to fight Assad and fight ISIS on the ground. We got a report this week that was startling. There are four or five, not 400 or 500, four or five rebels that we have trained with American military help and American might that are still there fighting the fight.
Yeah.
This is a failure in policy, isn't it?
Well, it is. And when I recommended it, it was several years ago. And I can't sit here and tell you that if we had done what I and General Petraeus and Secretary Panetta and others had recommended, we would have made more progress on the ground. I obviously thought so at the time, because as we look back, the people who were fighting Assad were you know, they were business people, they were students, they were professionals who had risen up against his tyrannical rule that had really kept so much of Syria under his thumb and before him, his father's thumb. If we had been able to move in to help organize and support those people on the ground, mm-hmm. maybe we could have made a difference. Well, we've got to deal with where we are right now. It's obviously now a different set of circumstances, and what the Pentagon has been doing hasn't worked.
You think
it really hasn't
saw a vacuum and is filling it because the U.S. has basically created a vacuum?
Well, you know, Putin's always had a very keen interest in Syria, and there are historical reasons for that. There are a lot of Russians, actually, who lived in Syria because a lot of Syrians went to Moscow to be educated during the Cold War. They brought back Russian husbands, Russian wives. There's a connection between the Syrian Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church. And as I think is clear, Putin is very focused on going after terrorists, obviously, inside Russia and on its borders, but even further afield. And they have a base. They've had a naval base there for a number of years. So he didn't just wake up and say, I'm going to go support Assad. There was a long-term relationship and, as he saw it, Russia's interests and securities. But I do think now that they are playing a bigger role, we have an additional challenge in trying to figure out how we work with them or how we try to prevent them from making a bad situation worse.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal American. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We've been playing a lot of Hillary Clinton's comments on Meet the Press. It's actually the Monday version. Actually, no one saw. One of the reasons why we've been playing it for you, because I think Hillary Clinton has a much more realistic understanding of foreign policy than President Obama. Now, I'm not completely knocking the president. I'd be the first to tell you that what's going on in Syria and Iraq is extremely hard, extremely complicated. It's very unfortunate that George Bush got us in this situation to begin with. And it's very unfair, I think, to blame President Obama for not dealing with all of the problems that began. It's kind of like a guy, I've always said that going into Iraq was kind of like a guy who complains of bee stings, or maybe I should say wasp stings, since bees actually are very good for flowers and stuff, and don't generally, do not attack you if not provoked. So let's say wasp, someone who complains about a wasp sting or a hornet sting, perhaps, and goes and sees a hornet's nest and says, I'm going to get those hornets, and takes a massive baseball bat and cracks it all open. Hornets get all over the place, starts stinging everyone. And then the guy says, all right, you're in charge, and hands you the bat and runs. A lot of that is sort of what George Obama in Iraq. He made a mess, a horrific mess, frankly, a very dangerous mess, and then left Barack Obama to deal with it. But Hillary Clinton is not talking about blame. She's talking about how we got there, but how we can go from here. Very, the actors in Syria, virtually all of them, and of course, the only people that Iran and Russia to murder are the few good people left, those in the Free Syrian Army. And I think Hillary Clinton is right to distinguish herself from Barack Obama. She famously said, I won't remember the exact stances of it, but that Obama's foreign policy was basically don't do stupid stuff. And well, that's quite harsh for a former Secretary of State to say. But in essence, she's exactly right. It's not enough of a foreign policy to say that you shouldn't do stupid things. You need to have a credible foreign policy. And frankly, I think she comes a long way in explaining that. She's much better, certainly, than Obama on that. I do want to hear from you, though. I want to know what you think of Hillary Clinton and her foreign policy and how it relates to President Obama. But there's more to the interview, and I'm going to want to play a lot more. Tell you what, let's play a little bit more from the interview, and then we'll talk about it on the other side of the break.
Move to Libya. Let me play something that you were caught on camera saying after Gaddafi was killed.
We came We saw he died.
I'm guessing that's not something you wanted to see out in public when it was done, but you were celebrating then. Is it still something worth celebrating, considering the where Libya is today? Was that actually the right call?
Well, you got to go back and see where we were. And remember, Gaddafi had American blood on his hands. He had been responsible for the murder of innocent passengers on an airline. He had supported terrorism. He was a bad actor.
He also was somebody that the Bush administration negotiated with and convinced to stop a nuclear program.
That's right. And that was good. That was a very big positive. But when it became clear that people in Libya were going to rise up against him, he also said he was going to hunt them down like cockroaches and kill them. And our European allies, who remember are on the doorstep of Libya, were adamant that we had to do something. And I think the way the United States supported what was primarily a joint European and Arab League effort against Gaddafi's forces was called for at the time.
But what was the mistake? Should we have had somebody on the boots on the ground to sort of build a post-Gaddafi Libya?
Well, I think that not just the United States. There were others who were involved in trying to, you know, prevent a massacre across Libya. And I think a lot of effort should have gone in to support. Remember, the Libyans have voted twice. And this is what's particularly sad, is that they voted twice for moderates to govern them. They participated in two elections to try to elect people that they thought would move them into the modern world, leaving the Gaddafi past behind. And they didn't get enough support internally, and they didn't get enough support externally, first and foremost from the people who were most heavily invested, the Europeans and the Arabs, in my opinion.
Hillary Clinton, again, I do think has the more realistic foreign policy. So let's take a break, and I'd like to hear what you think about it at 888-48-MARK, 888-48-6275. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We've been playing a lot of a transcript of Hillary Clinton's interview with Chuck Todd. It's largely an interview you probably missed. Hillary Clinton, frankly, has not been getting a lot of credit for her knowledge of policy. And Chuck Todd's questions about her email server took almost the entire time of the played on Meet the Press. But when he delves into policy, I think that's actually where you see Hillary Clinton at her best. And that's why I think she's going to do very well in the debates next week. Let's play more of the interview when they move on to domestic policy.
Let me go through some domestic issue. You came out and finally came out on Keystone, and you said you felt that you had to show some deference to the administration. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. You had said that before is down. Now that you're willing to say on Keystone, are you willing to say where you are in TPP?
As soon as I see what is in TPP, from what I hear, it's kind of a moving target. They haven't finished the negotiations. I've been very clear. If it does not support American jobs, if it does not give us the kind of advantages we need to keep the economy going, we had 3.9% growth last quarter. Yeah. We need to keep moving in that direction. And if it's not in our security interests, I'm not going to support it. And so once I have a chance to review it, I will state where I stand on it.
In 2007, during a debate, you said NAFTA was a mistake in hindsight. You still sort of believe that?
You know, at the time, I thought NAFTA held out a lot of promise, but the fact that a lot of the so-called side agreements were not actually in the treaty, I thought was a problem. And it has turned out that I don't think we had enough of an enforcement mechanism in dealing with NAFTA. Now, I don't think it's as, you know, bad or as good as either its detractors or its supporters say, but I think we've learned, or at least I hope we've learned, how better to do trade agreements. I voted against CAFTA when I was in the Senate because I didn't think the lessons had been learned. That's why I'm waiting to see what's in TPP.
Are there reasonable restrictions that you would ever support on abortion?
I've said that there were, and that's under Roe v. Wade, that there can be restrictions in the very end of the third trimester, but they have to take into account the life and health of the mother. I remember in '96, Chuck, my husband vetoed a very restrictive legislation on late-term abortions. And he vetoed it at an event in the White House where we invited a lot of women who had faced this very difficult decision that ought to be made based on their own conscience, their family, their faith, in consultation with doctors. Those stories left a searing impression on me. You know, women who think their pregnancy is going well and then wake up and find some really terrible problem. Women whose life is threatened themselves if they carry their child to term. And women who are told by doctors that the child they're carrying will not survive. And so, you know, again, I am where I have been, which is that, you know, if there is a way to structure some kind of constitutional restrictions that take into account the life of the mother and her health, then I'm open to that. But I have yet to see the Republicans willing to actually do that. And that would be an area where if they included health, you could see constitutional action.
If you you have said you're not running for Barack Obama's third term, where do you differ? What's a couple of places you differ? We talked about Syria and mm-hmm. in the administration, but where do you differ with them on domestic issues?
Look, I think I would have a different job. I have said I'm not my husband's third term either. Both of them faced economic challenges inherited from their Republican predecessors, and President Obama inherited the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. It was his job to stop the bleeding, begin to repair the economy, dig us out of the ditch we were in, which he has done, begin to see the recovery of jobs. But what we haven't seen is the recovery of incomes. We just haven't seen paychecks rising yet. People have not recovered either their paycheck right. or their wealth that was so devastated by the crisis of 07, 08, 09.
But where do you differ with the president?
Well, I have a different set of specific priorities because I will face a different set of issues. I also will defend the Affordable Care Act, but I want to take it further. I want to make improvements in it. I will defend Dodd-Frank, but I want to impose a much harsher set of restrictions based on risk on the financial market. So I think that it won't surprise you to hear that I believe the economy in the country does better under a Democratic president. So I want to build on what works from both my husband's term and President Obama's, but I want to go further, and I will face different challenges.
You've said that in 2007 that you would have some roles, that you had some roles in mind for your husband mm-hmm. if you get elected. What roles do you have in mind for him?
Well, he is a great advisor, and he knows as much about the economy and how to get jobs created and how to help people see their incomes rise as anybody that I could talk to. And I would love to have his...
So he'll have a West Wing office?
Well...
If you get there?
He's a pretty busy guy. I don't know anything like that, but I'm not looking, you know, I'm not counting my chickens before they hatch. I just want to be sure that we get the chance to earn the votes of the American people and to win the White House
well,
back.
Let me end with a question I asked you on Meet the Press. Where do you... Why should Democrats vote for you and not Bernie Sanders? Why are you a better Democratic nominee than Bernie Sanders?
Well, I'm not in any way going to criticize Senator Sanders. And he's running a great campaign, and I respect that. I can just tell you that I think my combination of experience, the fact that I have been a lifelong fighter for, you know, families and kids and women, and I think a lot of what we need to do in this country, whether it's equal pay for equal work, paid family leave, you know, creating early childhood education, support, you know, the family more, especially with raising incomes, is something that I have a lot of experience and ideas about doing. And I think it is significant that people that have worked with me in the Congress, you know, when I wasn't running for president, even Republicans right. were praising me. But the fact now that I have so many of my Democratic colleagues, present and former, in the House and the Senate, out in state houses, who right. are lined up to say, you know, this is the person we want to see as president, is very gratifying because they look at what they think I can do for them.
So Hillary Clinton, I really think, is giving some very strong answers. And one of the reasons I played it at length for you is because I don't think these kinds of answers are getting much play in the media. This is an interview that occurred on a Monday. It actually was pre-taped, but was shown on a Monday afternoon. Not many people saw this interview. And it was one where I think she gave very strong answers on the economy, on the Affordable Care Act, and frankly, how she differs from Barack Obama. Now, to be clear, this she is a different person, and she's going to be, in some ways, reintroduced to the American people at the Democratic debates on October 13th, next week. I want to introduce you beforehand. I also want to take a lot of your calls, and so we'll be right back with your calls. If you want to dial in, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
He's a Fulbright scholar, and he speaks French, but he couldn't tell you who won the Super Bowl. It's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I'm sorry about having a few technical problems today. I do want to go to my caller, Dave from Springfield, Massachusetts. I know he wanted to talk a little bit more about Syria. Dave, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Go ahead, Dave.
Okay.
Are you there, Dave?
Yes, I'd like to make some remarks about the government of Syria.
Okay.
And I want to say that the government of Syria, like has always been given a bad press in this country going back to the 1950s because it was a client state of the former Soviet Union, now called Russia. And going back before Hafez Assad's family and Bashar Assad ever took power, going back to the 1950s, the government of Syria has always been very tolerant of Christians, well-treated. Now they're not well-treated with the rise of the Islamic State crowd, who have committed horrible atrocities against Christians. They've committed horrible atrocities against Muslim. And in the case of Syria, Bashar Assad has nothing to be ashamed of. He has never committed anywhere near the wrongdoing against people committed by Islamic State.
Now, wait, hang on, Dave. I mean, okay, I'm going to agree with you, first of all, that the Islamic State has done horrific things against Muslims and Christians and Yazidis and other minorities. I'm certainly not defending them. But Bashar al-Assad has been dropping barrel bombs, these massive bomb villages. His father, Hafez al-Assad, took the fourth largest Syrian city, Hama, back 30 years ago and flattened it so that it ceases to exist right now. You're right that Assad has been somewhat kind to the Christian minority in Syria, and I think he's played them very well. He's a dictatorship, and he won support for his dictatorship, and the Christians were scared, and so he largely was okay to them. But please don't think that that means he's a good guy. He's killed hundreds of thousands of innocent people.
Well, the United States has never had the slightest amount of criticism against religious dictators like the United Arab Emirates, the government of Saudi Arabia, where you better be very careful if you ever talk about any other religion except Islam, and the governments of Islam, which have received the worst publicity in this country, was Nasser in Egypt because he was associated in part with the Soviet Union, and he treated the Christians very well, the people that are called the Coptic Christians, well-treated under Nasser, the Christian minority well-treated by Saddam Hussein over in Iraq, and as soon as the United States defeated the government of Iraq and occupied the country, the Christians began to be mistreated very terrible, and their entire community has been broken up and smashed as a result of the U.S.
Let me partly agree with you. All right. Okay. In the Middle East, there's a very, very difficult thing that good, ordinary people are stuck between, right? They're stuck between these horrific dictators, who truly are horrific, and Islamic fundamentalists, who also are truly horrific. And while you're right about the Christian minority, I don't think you can judge these dictators entirely by how they treated the Christian minority. You're absolutely right. The Islamic fundamentalist terrorists are completely cruel to the Christians, whether they be Coptic Christians in Egypt or the Christians in Syria. You're absolutely right about that. But the dictators are not good to their countries. They are murdering far more. Assad has much more blood on his hands even than ISIS. And ISIS has a substantial amount of blood on its hands. I do think there is a third way. In Tunisia, we have a secular Islamic government promoted by the people because of the Arab Spring that is good to Christians and is good to Muslims. In Libya, which is a lot more messy than Tunisia, the government certainly doesn't have as much control there. But again, you have a group that is neither Gaddafi, neither the dictator, nor Islamic fundamentalists. Now, the problem in Libya, of course, is that the government doesn't have a lot of power, a lot of control. But I think we're wrong if we try to say that anyone who helps the Christians is therefore a good person when they're going around killing hundreds of thousands of Muslims. I think we have to defend human life wherever it occurs. Does that make sense?
Well, if I were a Christian being brought up in Iraq or Syria or Egypt, I would much rather be under Nasser or the governments in Syria from the 1950s right up to the present, or Saddam Hussein, than I ever would be with the people who would replace them.
I hear what you're saying, but that's determining between two very, very evil groups. And the people in Syria that were trying to overthrow Assad, the original people, not ISIS, but the Free Syrian Army, had Christians in it. It had Muslims of all types. It was students and shopkeepers and good people. And I just think that when we say, well, whatever's good for the Christians is what's best, Assad was a brutal dictator. Gaddafi was a brutal dictator. Gaddafi threatened to kill hundreds of thousands of people. Saddam Hussein, frankly, was a pretty brutal dictator. I mean, I was opposed to the war in Iraq. I think we messed up things there. We never should have left that alone. But at the same time, I don't think you could say that Assad is some kind of good guy when he's murdered hundreds of thousands of people.
If the United States Congress had had the intelligence and wisdom to turn down both Bushes, Bush 1 and 2, when they decided to invade Iraq for incorrect reasons, all of this would not have happened.
You're right about that. You're absolutely right about that. And that's a point that I've made repeatedly on air. On there, we entirely agree, Dave.
I could never condemn any family more for the harm they brought into the world and the evil than the Bush family. They have done so much harm and viciousness as to be almost beyond comprehension.
Well, I mean, again, I am no fan of the Bushes either. I think you have to be careful when, I mean, it's not that your facts are wrong. You're right that the Christians did better under Assad than they do under ISIS. But I do think that we need to have a much more broadened look at what's going on there. And Assad has murdered hundreds of thousands of innocent Syrian, mostly Muslims. But at the same time, we cannot defend someone like that, even if he's killing Muslims rather than Christians. And so even though I accept your facts, I really think that we've got to look at humanity and say that we don't want anyone who's a mass murderer running countries. I will say this, though. You're right about Saudi Arabia. You're right about the UAE. I have condemned Saudi Arabia. It's not just Christians. They don't allow Jews. Henry Kissinger, in fact, had a special permission to come into Saudi Arabia. Women are notoriously mistreated. They can't drive. They don't have equal freedoms. It is important that we even talk to our allies, absolutely, about how they mistreat people. I mean, in Egypt, we have a new dictator who's actually pretty good to Coptic Christians. He's actually not bad to Israel, but he's clamping down on a lot of freedoms right there in Egypt. He's got a lot of journalists in jail. It's tough. It's really tough in these situations to try to find out who's a decent person there. There aren't many on any of these sides. And I think, though, that when we have mass murder going on, we've got to do our best to stop it. Otherwise, not only is it a humanitarian problem, but you have millions of refugees coming into Europe and coming to the United States as well.
In the case of these people like Nasser in Egypt, who died in 1970, and the governments in Syria, and Saddam Hussein, all of these governments were associated with secular governments.
That's true.
They were all secular leaders.
That's
and they refused to allow law Sharia to be the absolute law of the country. And that's one of the reasons they were so unpopular with the religious intolerant people of Islam.
That's true.
Because these people were secular leaders, and I want to repeat again, all of the governments in Europe, I mean Syria going back to the 50s, the government of Nasser and the government of Saddam Hussein, secular leaders, and they believed in religious tolerance for the Christian people.
I appreciate your call, Dave. You're right that they were secular, but they were also dictators. And the real problem in the Middle East has been that the people of the Middle East, and this is true whether it's Syria or Egypt or Iraq or, frankly, Iran or any of the other there, is that the people are stuck between these secular dictators who are their own people and mistreat their own people and don't allow any kind of freedom, and they're terrible, and Islamic fundamentalists who are honorable and add religious intolerance to the mix. My hope is a Middle East that is neither, and maybe you could say I'm a bit of a dreamer, but Tunisia has shown us a bit of the way out. Turkey has shown us a bit of the way out. And I think either one is the way to go. Thank you, Dave. Thanks for your call, and thanks for bringing up those points. I want to conclude with just a little bit more that Hillary Clinton had to say about her husband, Bill Clinton, and how he'd be involved in the Hillary Clinton administration.
I thought I was going to make that the last question, but I forgot about to ask you about Speaker Boehner. Why do you, this has been a challenge for this president, yeah, working with Republicans in Congress.
Right.
Why do you think you'll have better luck?
Look, I think that, first of all, you have to have an agenda you're running on that the American people believe is possible and can get the results that you're saying will come to them. I want to be able to say at the end of my first term, hey, what I've done has made life better for the vast majority of Americans. And I think that you've got to go in with an agenda so that it is policy-based, and then you begin the intensive effort to build relationships, even with people you don't agree with. I mean, I worked with Tom DeLay to reform the adoption and foster care system.
So you think you all have better relationships than Barack Obama?
Well, I have been in Washington, as you know, in and out for a while. I can see how things get done, and I know how much effort it takes to try to find that common ground. From day one, that's exactly what I'll be looking to do.
Secretary.
So that's Hillary Clinton.
Thanks.
By the way, I misstated the what I meant to say was she did talk about, that was the part about Speaker Boehner. She did talk about her relationship with Bill Clinton. She was asked what role he would play. And she said, well, he is a great advisor and he knows as much about the economy and how to get jobs created and how people see their incomes rise as anybody that I could talk to. And I'd love to have his advice. And I have to say, one of the biggest advantages of Hillary Clinton, yes, is her husband. Bill Clinton did preside over a very good American economy on a time of relative peace and prosperity. And I don't think it's bad for us to say, if you liked Bill Clinton, you should vote for Hillary Clinton too. I wanted to get her a word in edgewise. We've talked a lot about Donald Trump. Let's talk about the leading Democratic nominee. Hope you enjoyed the show. If you want to follow me on Twitter, just go to Mark Levine Talk. My website's marklevinetalk.com, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you.